my body's capacity to express what I felt. I damned, as an affront to her, the highest tribute I could give her. Just as they damn my ability to translate the work of my mind into Reardon metal. Just as they damn me for the power to transform matter to serve my needs. I accepted their code, and believed, as they taught me, that the values of one's spirit must remain as an impotent longing, unexpressed in action, untranslated into reality, while the life of one's body must be lived in misery, as a senseless, degrading performance. And those who attempt to enjoy it must be branded as inferior animals. I broke their code, but I fell into the trap they intended, the trap of a code devised to be broken. I took no pride in my rebellion. I took it as guilt. I did not damn them, I damned myself. I did not damn their code, I damned existence. And I hid my happiness as a shameful secret. I should have lived it openly, as of our right, or made her my wife, as in truth she was. But I branded my happiness as evil and made her bear it as a disgrace. What they want to do to her now, I did it first. I made it possible. I did it in the name of pity for the most contemptible woman I know. That too was their code, and I accepted it. I believed that one person owes a duty to another with no payment for it in return. I believed that it was my duty to love a woman who gave me nothing, who betrayed everything I lived for, who demanded her happiness at the price of mine. I believed that love is some static gift, which once granted need no longer be deserved, just as they believe that wealth is a static possession which can be seized and held without further effort. I believed that love is a gratuity, not a reward to be earned, just as they believe it is their right to demand an unearned wealth, and just as they believe that their need is a claim on my energy, so I believed that her unhappiness was a claim on my life. For the sake of pity, not justice, I endured 10 years of self-torture. I placed pity above my own conscience, and this is the core of my guilt. My crime was committed when I said to her, by every standard of mine, to maintain our marriage will be a vicious fraud, but my standards are not yours. I do not understand yours, I never have, but I will accept them. Here they are lying on my desk, those standards I accepted without understanding. Here is the manner of her love for me, that love which I never believed but tried to spare. Here is the final product of the unearned. I thought that it was proper to commit injustice so long as I would be the only one to suffer, but nothing can justify injustice. And this is the punishment for accepting as proper that hideous evil which is self-immolation. I thought that I would be the only victim. Instead, I've sacrificed the noblest woman to the vilest. When one acts on pity against justice, it is the good whom one punishes for the sake of the evil. When one saves the guilty from suffering, it is the innocent whom one forces to suffer. There is no escape from justice. Nothing can be unearned and unpaid for in the universe, neither in matter nor in spirit. And if the guilty do not pay, then the innocent have to pay it. It was not the cheap little looters of wealth who have beaten me. It was I. They did not disarm me. I threw away my weapon. This is a battle that cannot be fought except with clean hands, because the enemy's sole power is in the sores of one's conscience. And I accepted a code that made me regard the strength of my hands as a sin and a stain. Do we get the medal, Mr. Reardon? He looked from the gift certificate on his desk to the memory of the girl on the flat car. He asked himself whether he could deliver the radiant being he had seen in that moment to the looters of the mind and the thugs of the press. Could he continue to let the innocent bear punishment? Could he let her take the stand he should have taken? Could he now defy the enemy's code when the disgrace would be hers, not his? When the muck would be thrown at her, not at him? When she would have to fight, while he'd be spared? Could he let her existence be turned into a hell he would have no way of sharing? He sat still looking up at her. I love you, he said to the girl on the flat car, silently pronouncing the words that had been the meaning of that moment 4 years ago, feeling the solemn happiness that belonged with the words, even though this was how he had to say it to her for the first time. He looked down at the gift certificate. Dagny, he thought, you would not let me do it if you knew. You will hate me for it if you learn. But I cannot let you pay my debts. The fault was mine. and I will not shift to you the punishment which is mine to take. Even if I have nothing else now left to me, I have this much, that I see the truth, that I am free of their guilt, that I can now stand guiltless in my own eyes, that I know I am right, right fully and for the first time, and that I will remain faithful to the one commandment of my code which I have never broken, to be a man who pays his own way. I love you, he said to the girl on the flat car, feeling as if the light of that summer sun were touching his forehead, as if he too were standing under an open sky over an unobstructed earth, with nothing left to him except himself. Well, Mr. Reardon, are you going to sign? Asked Dr. Ferris. Reardon's eyes moved to him. He had forgotten that Ferris was there. He did not know whether Ferris had been speaking, arguing, or waiting in silence. Oh, that? Said Reardon. He picked up a pen, and with no second glance, with the easy gesture of a millionaire signing a check, he signed his name at the foot of the Statue of Liberty and pushed the gift certificate across the desk. Chapter 7. The Moratorium on Brains. Where have you been all this time? Eddie Willers asked the worker in the underground cafeteria, and added with a smile that was an appeal, an apology, and a confession of despair. Oh, I know it's I who've stayed away from here for weeks. The smile looked like the effort of a crippled child groping for a gesture that he could not perform any longer. I did come here once about 2 weeks ago, but you weren't here that night. I was afraid you'd gone. So many people are vanishing without notice. I hear there's hundreds of them roving around the country. The police have been arresting them for leaving their jobs. They're called deserters. But there's too many of them and no food to feed them in jail, so nobody gives a damn anymore one way or another. I hear the deserters are just wandering about doing odd jobs, or worse. Who's got any odd jobs to offer these days? It's our best men that we're losing, the kind who've been with the company for 20 years or more. Why did they have to chain them to their jobs? Those men never intended to quit. But now they're quitting at the slightest disagreement, just dropping their tools and walking off any hour of the day or night, leaving us in all sorts of jams. The men who used to leap out of bed and come running if the railroad needed them. You should see the kind of human driftwood we're getting to fill the vacancies. Some of them mean well, but they're scared of their own shadows. Others are the kind of scum I didn't think existed. They get the jobs, and they know that we can't throw them out once they're in, so they make it clear that they don't intend to work for their pay, and never did intend. They're the kind of men who like it, who like the way things are now. Can you imagine that there are human beings who like it? Well, there are. You know, I don't think that I really believe it, all that's happening to us these days. It's happening all right, but I don't believe it. I keep thinking that insanity is a state where a person can't tell what's real. Well, what's real now is insane. And if I accepted it as real, I'd have to lose my mind, wouldn't I? I go on working, and I keep telling myself that this is Taggart Transcontinental. I keep waiting for her to come back, for the door to open at any moment, and... Oh, God, I'm not supposed to say that. What? You knew it? You knew that she's gone? They're keeping it secret, but I guess everybody knows it. Only nobody is supposed to say it. They're telling people that she's away on a leave of absence. She's still listed as our vice president in charge of operations. I think Jim and I are the only ones who know that she has resigned for good. Jim is scared to death that his friends in Washington will take it out on him if it becomes known that she's quit. It's supposed to be disastrous for public morale if any prominent person quits, and Jim doesn't want them to know that he's got a deserter right in his own family. But that's not all. Jim is scared that the stockholders, the employees, and whoever we do business with will lose the last of their confidence in Taggart Transcontinental if they learn that she's gone. Confidence! You'd think that it wouldn't matter now, since there's nothing any of them can do about it. And yet Jim knows that we have to preserve some semblance of the greatness that Taggart Transcontinental once stood for. And he knows that the last of it went with her. No, they don't know where she is. Yes, I do, but I won't tell them. I'm the only one who knows. Oh, yes, they've been trying to find out. They've tried to pump me in every way they could think of, but it's no use. I won't tell anyone. You should see the trained seal that we now have in her place, our new operating vice president, Oh, sure, we have one. That is, we have and we haven't. It's like everything they do today. It is and it ain't at the same time. His name is Clifton Losey. He's from Jim's personal staff. A bright, progressive young man of 47 and a friend of Jim's. He's only supposed to be pinch-hitting for her, but he sits in her office, and we all know that that's the new operating vice president. He gives the orders. That is, he sees to it that he's never caught actually giving an order. He works very hard at making sure that no decision can ever be pinned down on him, so that he won't be blamed for anything. You see, his purpose is not to operate a railroad, but to hold a job. He doesn't want to run trains. He wants to please Jim. He doesn't give a damn whether there's a single train moving or not, so long as he can make a good impression on Jim and on the boys in Washington. So far, Mr. Clifton Losey has managed to frame up two men, a young third assistant for not relaying an order which Mr. Losey had never given, and the freight manager for issuing an order which Mr. Losey did give, only the freight manager couldn't prove it. Both men were fired officially by ruling of the Unification Board. When things go well, which is never longer than half an hour, Mr. Losey makes it a point to remind us that these are not the days of Miss Taggart. At the first sign of trouble, he calls me into his office and asks me, casually, in the midst of the most irrelevant drivel, what Miss Taggart used to do in such an emergency. I tell him whenever I can. I tell myself that it's Taggart Transcontinental, and there's thousands of lives on dozens of trains that hang on our decisions. Between emergencies, Mr. Losey goes out of his way to be rude to me, that so I wouldn't think that he needs me. He's made it a point to change everything she used to do, in every respect that doesn't matter. But he's damn cautious not to change anything that matters. The only trouble is that he can't always tell which is which. On his first day in her office, he told me that it wasn't a good idea to have a picture of Nat Taggart on the wall. Nat Taggart, he said, belongs to a dark past, to the age of selfish greed. He is not exactly a symbol of our modern progressive policies. So it could make a bad impression. People could identify me with him. No, they couldn't, I said. But I took the picture off his wall. What? No, she doesn't know any of it. I haven't communicated with her. Not once. She told me not to. Last week I almost quit. It was over Chick's special. Mr. Chick Morrison of Washington, whoever the hell he is, has gone on a speaking tour of the whole country, to speak about the directive and build up the people's morale as things are getting to be pretty wild everywhere. He demanded a special train for himself and party, a sleeper, a parlor car, and a diner with barroom and lounge. The Unification Board gave him permission to travel at 100 miles an hour, by reason the ruling said of this being a non-profit journey. Well, so it is. It's just a journey to talk people into continuing to break their backs at making profits in order to support men who are superior by reason of not making any. Well, our trouble came when Mr. Chick Morrison demanded a diesel engine for his train. We had none to give him. Every diesel we own is out on the road pulling the Comet and the transcontinental freights, and there wasn't a spare one anywhere in the system except... Well, that was an exception I wasn't going to mention to Mr. Clifton Losey. Mr. Losey raised the roof, screaming that come hell or high water, we couldn't refuse a demand of Mr. Chick Morrison. I don't know what damn fool finally told him about the extra diesel that was kept at Winston, Colorado, at the mouth of the tunnel. You know the way our diesels break down nowadays. They're all breathing their last. So you can understand why that extra diesel had to be kept at the tunnel. I explained it to Mr. Losey. I threatened him. I pleaded. I told him that she had made it our strictest rule that Winston Station was never to be left without an extra diesel. He told me to remember that he was not Miss Taggart, as if I could ever forget it, and that the rule was nonsense because nothing had happened all these years, so Winston could do without a diesel for a couple of months, and he wasn't going to worry about some theoretical disaster in the future when we were up against the very real, practical, immediate disaster of getting Mr. Chick Morrison angry at us. Well, Chick Special got the diesel. The superintendent of the Colorado Division quit. Mr. Losey gave that job to a friend of his own. I wanted to quit. I'd never wanted to so badly. But I didn't. No, I haven't heard from her. I haven't heard a word since she left. Why do you keep questioning me about her? Forget it, she won't be back. I don't know what it is that I'm hoping for. Nothing, I guess. I just go day by day and I try not to look ahead. At first I hoped that somebody would save us. I thought maybe it would be Hank Reardon, but he gave in. I don't know what they did to him to make him sign, but I know that it must have been something horrible. Everybody thinks so. Everybody's whispering about it, wondering what sort of pressure was used on him. No, nobody knows. He's made no public statements, and he's refused to see anyone. But listen, I'll tell you something that everybody's whispering about. Lean closer, will you? I don't want to speak too loudly. They say that Orrin Boyle seems to have known about that directive long ago, weeks or months in advance, because he had started quietly and secretly to reconstruct his furnaces for the production of Reardon metal in one of his lesser steel plants, an obscure little place way out on the coast of Maine. He was ready to start pouring the metal the moment Reardon's extortion paper, gift certificate, was signed. But listen, the night before they were to start, Boyle's men were heating the furnaces in that place on the coast when they heard a voice. They didn't know whether it came from a plane or a radio or some sort of loudspeaker, but it was a man's voice, and it said that he would give them 10 minutes to get out of the place. They got out. They started going, and they kept on going, because the man's voice had said that he was Ragnar Danishold. In the next half hour, Boyle's mills were razed to the ground, razed, wiped out, not a brick of them left standing. They say it was done by long-range naval guns from somewhere way out on the Atlantic. Nobody saw Danishold's ship. That's what people are whispering. The newspapers haven't printed a word about it. The boys in Washington say that it's only a rumor spread by panic mongers. I don't know whether the story is true. I think it is. I hope it is. You know, when I was 15 years old, I used to wonder how any man could become a criminal. I couldn't understand what would make it possible. Now I'm glad that Ragnar Danishold has blown up those mills. May God bless him and never let them find him, whatever and wherever he is. Yes, that's what I've come to feel. Well, how much do they think people can take? It's not so bad for me in the daytime because I can keep busy and not think, but it gets me at night. I can't sleep anymore. I lie awake for hours. Yes, if you want to know it, yes, it's because I'm worried about her. I'm scared to death for her. Woodstock is just a miserable little hole of a place miles away from anything, and the Taggart Lodge is 20 miles farther, 20 miles of a twisting trail in a godforsaken forest. How do I know what might happen to her there, alone, and with the kind of gangs that are roving all through the country these nights? Just through such desolate parts of the country as the Berkshires. I know I shouldn't think about it. I know that she can take care of herself, only I wish she'd drop me a line. I wish I could go there. But she told me not to. I told her I'd wait. You know, I'm glad you're here tonight. It helps me talking to you and just seeing you here. You won't vanish like all the others, will you? What? Next week? Oh, on your vacation. For how long? How do you rate a whole month's vacation? I wish I could do that, too, take a month off at my own expense, but they wouldn't let me. Really? I envy you. I wouldn't have envied you a few years ago, but now I'd like to get away. Now I envy you, if you've been able to take a month off every summer for 12 years. It was a dark road, but it led in a new direction. Reardon walked from his mills, not toward his house, but toward the city of Philadelphia. It was a great distance to walk, but he had wanted to do it tonight, as he had done it every evening of the past week. He felt at peace in the empty darkness of the countryside, with nothing but the black shapes of trees around him, with no motion but that of his own body, and of branches stirring in the wind, with no lights but the slow sparks of the fireflies flickering through the hedges. The 2 hours between mills and city were his span of rest. He had moved out of his home to an apartment in Philadelphia. He had given no explanation to his mother and Philip. He had said nothing except that they could remain in the house if they wished, and that Miss Ives would take care of their bills. He had asked them to tell Lillian when she returned that she was not to attempt to see him. They had stared at him in terrified silence. He had handed to his attorney a signed blank check and said, "Get me a divorce, on any grounds and at any cost. I don't care what means you use, how many of their judges you purchase, or whether you find it necessary to stage a frame-up of my wife. Do whatever you wish. But there is to be no alimony, and no property settlement. The attorney had looked at him with the hint of a wise, sad smile, as if this were an event he had expected to happen long ago. He had answered, "Okay, Hank, it can be done, but it will take some time. Make it as fast as you can." No one had questioned him about his signature on the gift certificate, but he had noticed that the men at the mills looked at him with a kind of searching curiosity, almost as if they expected to find the scars of some physical torture on his body. He felt nothing, nothing but the sense of an even, restful twilight, like a spread of slag over a molten metal when it crusts and swallows the last brilliant spurt of the white glow within. He felt nothing at the thought of the looters who were now going to manufacture Reardon metal. His desire to hold his right to it, and proudly to be the only one to sell it, had been his form of respect for his fellow men, his belief that to trade with them was an act of honor. The belief, the respect, and the desire were gone. He did not care what men made, what they sold, where they bought his metal, or whether any of them would know that it had been his. The human shapes moving past him in the streets of the city were physical objects without any meaning. The countryside, with the darkness washing away all traces of human activity, leaving only an untouched earth which he had once been able to handle, was real. He carried a gun in his pocket, as advised by the policeman of the radio car that patrolled the roads. They had warned him that no road was safe after dark these days. He felt, with a touch of mirthless amusement, that the gun had been needed at the mills, not in the peaceful safety of loneliness and night. What could some starving vagrant take from him, compared to what had been taken by men who claimed to be his protectors? He walked with an effortless speed, feeling relaxed by a form of activity that was natural to him. This was his period of training for solitude, he thought. He had to learn to live without any awareness of people, the awareness that now paralyzed him with revulsion. He had once built his fortune, starting out with empty hands. Now he had to rebuild his life, starting out with an empty spirit. He would give himself a short span of time for the training, he thought, and then he would claim the one incomparable value still left to him, the one desire that had remained pure and whole. He would go to Dagny. Two commandments had grown in his mind. One was a duty, the other a passionate wish. The first was never to let her learn the reason of his surrender to the looters. The second was to say to her the words which he should have known at their first meeting, and should have said on the gallery of Ellis Wyatt's house. There was nothing but the strong summer starlight to guide him as he walked, but he could distinguish the highway and the remnant of a stone fence ahead at the corner of a country crossroad. The fence had nothing to protect any longer, only a spread of weeds, a willow tree bending over the road, and farther in the distance, the ruin of a farmhouse with the starlight showing through its roof. He walked, thinking that even this sight still retained the power to be of value. It gave him the promise of a long stretch of space undisturbed by human intrusion. The man who stepped suddenly out into the road must have come from behind the willow tree, but so swiftly that it seemed as if he had sprung up from the middle of the highway. Reardon's hand went to the gun in his pocket, but stopped. He knew, by the proud posture of the body standing in the open, by the straight line of the shoulders against the starlit sky, that the man was not a bandit. When he heard the voice, he knew that the man was not a beggar. "I should like to speak to you, Mr. Reardon." The voice had the firmness, the clarity, and the special courtesy peculiar to men who are accustomed to giving orders. "Go ahead," said Reardon, "provided you don't intend to ask me for help or money." The man's garments were rough, but efficiently trim. He wore dark trousers and a dark blue windbreaker closed tight at his throat, prolonging the lines of his long, slender figure. He wore a dark blue cap, and all that could be seen of him in the night were his hands, his face, and a patch of gold-blonde hair on his temple. The hands held no weapon, only a package wrapped in burlap, the size of a carton of cigarettes. "No, Mr. Reardon," he said, "I don't intend to ask you for money, but to return it to you." "To return money?" "Yes." "What money?" "A small refund on a very large debt." "Owed by you?" "No, not by me." It is only a token payment, but I want you to accept it as proof that if we live long enough, you and I, every dollar of that debt will be returned to you.
What debt?
The money that was taken from you by force.
He extended the package to Reardon, flipping the burlap open. Reardon saw the starlight run like fire along a mirror-smooth surface. He knew by its weight and texture that what he held was a bar of solid gold. He looked from the bar to the man's face, but the face seemed harder and less revealing than the surface of the metal.
"Who are you?" asked Reardon.
"The friend of the friendless."
"Did you come here to give this to me?"
"Yes."
"Do you mean that you had to stalk me at night on a lonely road in order not to rob me, but to hand me a bar of gold?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"When robbery is done in open daylight by sanction of the law, as it is done today, then any act of honor or restitution has to be hidden underground."
"What made you think that I'd accept a gift of this kind?"
"It is not a gift, Mr. Reardon. It is your own money.
But I have one favor to ask of you. It is a request, not a condition, because there can be no such thing as conditional property. The gold is yours, so you are free to use it as you please. But I risked my life to bring it to you tonight. So I am asking as a favor that you save it for the future, or spend it on yourself, on nothing but your own comfort and pleasure. Do not give it away, and above all, do not put it into your business." "Why?"
"Because I don't want it to be of any benefit to anybody but you. Otherwise, I will have broken an oath taken long ago, as I am breaking every rule I had set for myself by speaking to you tonight."
"What do you mean?"
"I have been collecting this money for you for a long time, but I did not intend to see you or tell you about it or give it to you until much later."
"Then why did you?"
"Because I couldn't stand it any longer."
"Stand what?"
"I thought that I had seen everything one could see and that there was nothing I could not stand seeing. But when they took Reardon metal away from you, it was too much, even for me. I know that you don't need this gold at present. What you need is the justice which it represents, and the knowledge that there are men who care for justice."
Struggling not to give in to an emotion which he felt rising through his bewilderment, past all his doubts, Reardon tried to study the man's face, searching for some clue to help him understand. But the face had no expression. It had not changed once while speaking. It looked as if the man had lost the capacity to feel long ago, and what remained of him were only features that seemed implacable and dead. With a shudder of astonishment, Reardon found himself thinking that it was not the face of a man, but of an avenging angel.
"Why did you care?" asked Reardon. "What do I mean to you?"
"Much more than you have reason to suspect. And I have a friend to whom you mean much more than you will ever learn. He would have given anything to stand by you today, but he can't come to you, so I came in his place."
"What friend?"
"I prefer not to name him."
"Did you say that you've spent a long time collecting this money for me?"
"I have collected much more than this." He pointed at the gold. "I am holding it in your name, and I will turn it over to you when the time comes. This is only a sample as proof that it does exist. And if you reach the day when you find yourself robbed of the last of your fortune, I want you to remember that you have a large bank account waiting for you."
"What account?"
"If you try to think of all the money that has been taken from you by force, you will know that your account represents a considerable sum."
"How did you collect it?
Where did this gold come from?"
"It was taken from those who robbed you."
"Taken by whom?"
"By me."
"Who are you?"
"Ranyer Danishuld."
Reardon looked at him for a long, still moment, then let the gold fall out of his hands.
Danishuld's eyes did not follow it to the ground, but remained fixed on Reardon with no change of expression. "Would you rather I were a law-abiding citizen, Mr. Reardon? If so, which law should I abide by? Directive 10-289?
"Ranyer Danishuld," said Reardon, as if he were seeing the whole of the past decade, as if he were looking at the enormity of a crime spread through 10 years and held within two words.
Look more carefully, Mr. Reardon. There are only two modes of living left to us today, to be a looter who robs disarmed victims, or to be a victim who works for the benefit of his own despoilers. I did not choose to be either. You chose to live by means of force like the rest of them. Yes. Open.